The following is presented as an entertainment program emphasizing folklore. It is not intended as legal or medical advice in any way and should not be used to replace the advice of legal or medical professionals. New World Witchery is a Patreon-supported podcast. This episode is supported by listener Lisa. We want to thank Lisa for her generosity, and we'll be rewarding her with a ride on our personal New World Witchery Luck Dragon, which we recently hatched from an egg bathed in a mystical wishing well. The good news is that the dragon is healthy and happy. The bad news is that dragons grow very slowly, so Lisa, you may have to wait a millennium or two before he's ready to ride. If you'd like to become a patron and help support the show while also getting some great perks, please visit www.patreon.com/newworldwitchery, where you can pledge a dollar a month or whatever you can to help us buy that rapid growth luck dragon food at the local mythical Petco. It's so expensive, but it's worth it for our wriggly little guy. And thanks to all of our listeners.
Are you looking for magic? Maybe magic that lives right where you do?
If so, join us aboard our broomsticks and ride with us from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Yukon to the Yucatan, and find magic that's right outside your front door or just off of Route 66.
Whether you're in the Windy City or the Crescent City, the city that never sleeps, or the city of brotherly love, we've got enchantment for you.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane, and this is New World Witchery.
This time around, we're talking with an expert on Chinese mythology and folklore. The Foolish Dragon, a folktale of China. In years gone by, a dragon living in the great sea saw that his wife's health was not good. He, seeing her color fade away, said, "My dear, what shall I get you to eat?" Mrs. Dragon was silent. "Just tell me and I will get it," pleaded the affectionate husband. "You cannot do it. Why trouble?" quoth she. "Trust me and you shall have your heart's desire," said the dragon. "Well, I want a monkey's heart to eat." "Why, Mrs. Dragon, the monkeys live in the mountain forests. How can I get one of their hearts?" "Well, I'm going to die. I know I am." Forthwith, the dragon went on shore, and spying a monkey on the top of the tree, he said, "Hail, Shining One! Are you not afraid you will fall?" "No, I have no such fear," said the monkey. "Why, eat of one tree. Cross the sea, and you will find forests of fruit and flowers." "How can I cross?" asked the monkey. "Get on my back," said the dragon. The dragon, with his tiny load, went seaward, and then suddenly dived down. "Oh, where are you going?" said the monkey, with salt water in his eyes and mouth. "Oh, my dear sir, my wife is very sad and ill, and has taken a fancy to eating your heart." "Oh, what shall I do?" thought the monkey. Then he spoke. "Illustrious friend, why did you not tell me? I left my heart at the top of the tree. Take me back, and I will get it as a gift for Mrs. Dragon." The dragon returned to shore. As the monkey was tardy in coming down from the tree, the dragon said, "Hurry up, little friend, I am waiting." Then the monkey thought within himself, "What a fool this dragon is." Then the Buddha, repeating this story, said to his followers, "At this time, I was the monkey." This story was imported into Chinese folklore from oral traditions in Indian Buddhism, and we find an old version of it in the classic text, the Chikata Tales. In that version, the monkey remains, but the water dragon is now a crocodile, and portrayed as somewhat stupid and dull. So why the changes? "At this time, I was the monkey," said the Buddha. "But why? Is the monkey the hero of this story? After all, his self-preservation is understandable, as is his clever trickery. But we also know that his decision to fool the water dragon will lead to the dragon wife's death." Is the Buddha telling listeners to cling to life the way the monkey does? Is he admonishing himself for experiencing the desire for better fruits and better places, thus placing himself in danger? Chinese traditions are often very cosmopolitan, drawing from numerous traditions at once and commingling them together to create something new. So it is with this story. For example, Taoist principles of wisdom and virtue may influence our understanding of the monkey's trickery in the tale. The dragon, being highly revered for its wisdom, is only outsmarted by something cunning like a monkey, and we may even pity him and his wife. Influences from India, Africa, Mongolia, and beyond all meet at the crossroads of China, and China has long been one of the world's most expansive empires. With so many people, it makes sense that many beliefs, traditions, and stories should wind up interweaving and growing together as they do. That's also true for the gods and spirits of China, who frequently can represent ideas or narratives handed down from Buddhism, Taoism, and even Christianity and Zoroastrianism. Our guest tonight is Xueting Christine Ni, who has written several books on Chinese cultural traditions, including the way that deities, spirits, and folktales have come through time to be not only representative of China's past, but also present in China, and the Chinese diaspora of today. We hope you enjoy our conversation with her.
Xueting Xi Ni is the author of From Kuan Yin to Chairman Mao, The Essential Guide to Chinese Deities, as well as the editor of the recent collection Synopticon, A Celebration of Chinese Science Fiction, and the upcoming release, Chinese Myths. Xueting, welcome to New World Witchery.
Thank you, Corey. It's great to be on your podcast.
Well, thank you. We're so glad to have you here. And I guess we should start by talking about this concept of Chinese identity, because I know that you were born in Guangzhou, and then you've lived kind of in England, you lived in China, you lived in a lot of places. And I think that's something that a lot of people can identify with, is this sort of living in different spaces, in different places, at different times. And China itself is kind of a crossroads of a lot of cultural interchanges. So I'm curious, what influences do you see that have led to kind of what we might think of as Chinese identity today?
Well, in terms of beliefs, you have the indigenous system of Taoism, Buddhism, which came into China quite early on in history, kind of, and became and flourished during the Tang Dynasty, and then grew its own branches. Then you have Confucianism, which isn't really a belief as such, more a system of political thought, but nevertheless, the key scholars in the school of thought were kind of elevated to deity status. And then you have folklore. All of these kind of are part of the traditional identity, of part of the traditional belief system. Right up until the end of the dynastic era, a lot of indent. Actually, some of it overlapped into the Republic era, mm-hmm. as things always do in history. And then you have modern China, modern Chinese identity, which is very different. It's quite westernized and sort of post-Cultural Revolution and post open door policy. And between these, there is a sort of societal divide, because during certain historical events, such as the Cultural Revolution, anything to do with the past, anything old was frowned upon. So there was a severing with tradition. And what's very interesting about identities now is that people are, I think, forming new identities, and they're looking back into their past to do so, meeting with tradition and customs and the old beliefs, but in new ways. In terms of other intersections, I mean, we had Christianity, which entered China quite a few centuries before the end of the dynastic era, with the Jesuits, and later with commerce and with people going over there for trade, and then the semi-colonial era as well. Then you have other religions, because China is such a diverse place, you have other religions like Islam, like some of the lesser known ones like Zoroastrian traditions. They prop up in different parts of China. Some of them have integrated more into mainstream society than others. But one thing that does tend to happen in Chinese identities in China is that things tend to get absorbed and then they combine with the local traditions or what the existing beliefs, and they form something new or hybrids. So I would say now it's a very interesting time in terms of identities.
And it's also interesting because obviously we're a much more kind of global community now, where people are circulating kind of around the globe. So people may be part of that diaspora as well. And I'm curious, you know, how sort of religion and folk belief and the spiritual practice, is it, do you feel like it is different among the diaspora than it is among those who practice within mainland China? Or is it something where there's just kind of a constant interchange and people are exchanging ideas all the time?
It's certainly different. When you leave your native country and then you move somewhere else, you kind of take this cultural snapshot with you. That's your idea and picture of the world. And then that doesn't change. But of course, this ecosystem changes constantly in its place where it's alive. It's different in that sense. But of course, with diaspora, we are more in contact with whatever the main religion, main belief systems and cultures are of the place where we live. So as well as being, maybe we may be familiar or not be with the culture of our heritage. So I would consider myself diaspora. I'm first generation Chinese immigrant, although it's not what is generally assumed for this definition. So I don't tend to say that, because I was born in China, but I spent and I had a very had a very memorable childhood there, but spent some of my most important years in the UK. So I would say that my identity, both China and Britain, are part of my identity. Mm-hmm. And something else, I'm part of both of these worlds and distance as well. And I think I have quite a broad view of diaspora. I think it's anybody that lives away from their home culture, that they reside in a different place.
And that makes a lot of sense to kind of think of that as home culture versus kind of the place where you are. And I know that you've obviously had a chance to kind of return to China as well, and you do a lot of speaking and writing on that experience. And I think that it can be, for those who are not familiar with, you know, aspects of Chinese history or folklore or legend, I think it can be a little surprising just how integrated so much of that can be into daily life without necessarily being, you know, a big, you know, sort of, it's not like a, you know, a go to church on Sunday kind of an approach to things. It's a very much sort of, it's part of everyday life, sort of spiritual identity. Which kind of brings us into some things to talk about with the book. And the book here that we're mostly going to be talking about is From Kuan Yin to Chairman Mao. Although I'd love for you to add in anything from your recent work in Chinese myths as well. But one of the points that I think we should probably address is your book, From Kuan Yin to Chairman Mao, talks about, it says it's the essential guide to Chinese deities. And that word deities, I think for a lot of people in the West, they have either a very monolithic, monotheistic view of what a deity is, or they may sort of think back to ancient Greece or ancient Rome and have this sort of very specific idea of what those gods are. But in Chinese folk belief, at least as you've sort of written about it, a deity may be a little different than that. And I'm curious, kind of, what does deity mean to you, and how do people interact with these kind of deities in Chinese folk belief?
So first of all, I want to return to the second question, sure, which actually leads on to this one, what I need to say. So in terms of cultural snapshots I took with me when I came to the UK, I kind of took this, and when I returned to China in my adult life, I took this and sought out the origins of these snapshots, these memories of the very vibrant local rituals and folk customs and folk beliefs. And I researched how they've developed and what they are like now. So this is very much how the book came about, how Kuan Yin Chen Mao came about.
Mm-hmm.
It's how they've developed since my initial spark of interest was from those childhood memories. The book is very much about how they've developed since and their relevance in contemporary society. In terms of yes, the definition is a lot looser in the Chinese pantheons, where I would say it's any being in any field, any kind of being that you feel you could call upon their powers, or entrust one's hopes and fears with. It could be any type of being, a god or a human being who became a god or an icon. And this really pertains to the way that gods are created in the Chinese systems. On the one side, you have very kind of formal pantheons in the Buddhist tradition and in the Taoist tradition. These were kind of established than the very kind of primeval supernatural beings. And then on the other hand, you have folklore, which kind of takes what it wants from the Taoist pantheon and the Buddhist pantheon, with its quite representative gods and quite hierarchical systems, and just does what it likes with it, dropping things, adding things, forming new identities, new guises for these beings. And a lot of them are humans to begin with, are actual real life people who, because of their deeds, became remembered after their deaths or after their lifetimes, and became sort of treated like deity.
And I mean, I love that you bring in the folklore component of this, because I think that is so important, that ability to let the people, let everyday people sort of take the stories and make them their own. And I'm curious, you know, what are some of the kind of maybe key folkloric tales, or what might be a good example of a folkloric tale that has been really influential in the way that Chinese folk religion, folk belief is practiced?
So the moon lady, or the moon spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think because they are so much tied to social practices and daily lives, they're kind of integrated, embedded into these. There's always going to be an interaction between the folk practices and the development of the deity, the development of the legend. So the moon spirits are a great example, because there has been several guises for the... Okay, so I'm thinking of Wen Chang, who is the patron god of scholars, and also in his more household guise, a patron god of success, in terms of as in one's office, in one's work. So I think he was practiced, in the past, whereas you would perhaps make offerings to Wen Chang temples in the past, you might still do that in the present, but also you might, the way that you make the offerings would be updated with the current technology. So you may, instead of making a donation, for example. So instead of lighting a candle and making a donation of coins, you might tap your phone for the... I'm sorry, I'm a bit tired today. Okay. So you might tap your phone and to the QR code which they have in temples now, make your donations that way. You might do something online. And whereas he will always be the patron saint of scholarly success. And his field includes all kinds of things to do with writing. So you might find kind of online practices or, you know, websites named after Wenchang. And he's also lent his name to the Space Launch Center.
Oh, okay.
A lot of the rockets and satellites are launched these days in China. That's, I think, an example of how the practice, how folk practices have changed.
I love that. I think you've made that make a lot of sense in terms of he had a sort of historical way to be honored and interacted with, but now there's kind of some new contemporary ways that we've updated that, which is, I think, very true of a lot of folk belief and folk practices. I was just thinking, the folk tales and the myths, I think myths and folk tales have a lot of shared DNA, obviously. And so they both kind of influence how people are thinking about deities and thinking about kind of the greater world they live in. Which I guess brings us to questions of cosmology as well, and sort of how Chinese people and people in the Chinese diaspora might think about concepts. And so, people may have heard those terms before, but I think within Chinese mythology, they're not exactly the same as sort of the Western conception of that. So I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about that cosmology?
Yeah, it's certainly very different from the Western conception, in that we also have ideas of heaven and hell. However, the Chinese one is a combination of, I guess, Taoism, the Taoist and Buddhist one, and has a lot to do with the idea of cycle and reincarnation. Whereas heaven, the Chinese heaven tends to be a place for people who stood out because of they've done something very well or in very interesting ways. So, and whereas hell is more linked to the mortal world, and you are in this eternal cycle where if there are enough good deeds, then there are more chances of being a human in the next life, rather than another animal. Or the worst is if you've done a lot of bad things, you might come back as a fly. An insect. One major difference, another one is that, and it's both heaven and hell are quite bureaucratic in a sense. There are lots of gods in heaven, a combination of Buddhist pantheons. There are thousands and millions of them, and they all have the hierarchies, they all live in heaven, they run the other realms. And in hell there are many, many layers with many, many different types of tortures, but also the idea of 10 gates, and each of them would have their own, the king of each gate, and you would go through, the soul of the dead would go through and be interrogated on their deeds of their previous life, and if they get through, they get reincarnated, they get to go to their next life, but not before they drink the soup of Mengpo, the last gate, which makes them forget their previous life. So it's all quite administrative and bureaucratic in that sense. So that's the main difference, really. And I've written a chapter on this at the beginning of Chinese myths, in terms of the cosmology, like in terms of creation. You have the major creative myths of Pangu and the egg, and him separating heaven and earth from that. the giant that sleeps in the egg for millions of years before he wakes up, and then his different parts of him become the, when he separates them and stands up, and then he, when he separates them, he falls down. When he dies, his different parts of his body become different parts of the world. It's roughly this story. Mm-hmm. And then you have also Nuwa, who is one of the older goddesses that created human. So you have some major myths, and then you have lots of different kinds of creative myths from different ethnic groups. One's about sky ladders, one's about other explanations for why the heaven and earth grew apart from the primeval chaotic mass. So I'd say there are many different, so it's all quite, it's a very dynamic, but that's, those are the main differences.
I love that. And one of the things that you mentioned, I mean, obviously I think the bureaucracy is really indicative of, I would venture to say maybe some of that Confucian history, obviously, because Confucian history is very rooted in kind of ideas of legalism and, you know, thinking bureaucratically in certain ways. But you made the point about in heaven, or in sort of the concepts of heaven, oftentimes you have these sort of hero figures or people who've lived exemplary lives. And you make the point that, you know, ancestors and human heroes are a part of this. And I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about the role of ancestor veneration as a part of this spiritual practice, and how important are ancestors to sort of the daily lives of people practicing sort of Chinese folk belief?
Yeah, so that's really been cemented into the culture by Confucian, really. The cult of ancestors, that's what Confucianism, part of it, seems to be very much founded upon. So in the historical times, you would have an ancestral altar, an ancestral shrine separate from one's house, that with altars and tomb, or maybe bigger tombs, that one would go and pay one's respects to the ancestors with their memorial plaques, memorial styles. Permanently, incense are lit and, you know, offerings are made. Mm. And then I think, I mean, even in modern times, there are occasions the year, traditional festivals that are still observed, where such as the, or known as tomb sweeping day sometimes, where you would go and clean the tombs of deceased family members or several generations up ancestors and commemorate them. I think recently there's been a revival of a kind of ancestral veneration and sort of this family clans getting together and maybe some of them building new ancestral shrines and having kind of large gatherings to observe this. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really good example of kind of how that works in daily life. You've done a lot of research for both from Kuan Yin to Chairman Mao and for Chinese myths. You've done tons of research for your website, looking at all different aspects of Chinese culture. I'm curious, kind of as you have worked your way through all of these legends and myths and stories, are there one or two that really stand out to you as kind of favorites for you personally, or are there deities that you personally kind of most closely identify with?
So what I always find most interesting is the cultural impact and social impact of deities and kind of different belief systems. And I think probably, so the ones that I really like are the ones that are kind of interesting in different ways, like Nuwa, whom I mentioned, who is an older, much older goddess, and who created humans because she really liked the world. And I also find it interesting how she, earlier forms were serpentine. Mm-hmm. And this kind of raises one of the cultural inversions, of which there are many, between China and the West. Snakes snakes can be an auspicious creature in traditional culture. And then she became more unfruitful as time went on. And then she created humans because she really liked the world, and then really used her resourcefulness to save the world when it was about to be destroyed, when the pillars were the two gods of water and fire. They were having a battle and destroyed one of the pillars that were holding up the sky, and she repaired it. So I really like that story, and I find it kind of maybe more interesting than Depart, who is Foresee, and who's been kind of attributed a whole range of things that he's supposedly, I think, have created. And they are supposed to be the ancestors of the mythical ancestors of mankind, the Chinese gods. So I think there's a lot of charm to this story, and she's a very powerful figure, positive icon. And then what I find interesting are gods like Jonquay, who is one of the very few kind of half-demon slayers in the pantheon. And then also he had a very kind of strange and interesting origin. And then people like Li Mo, or she was also known as Ma Zu, a goddess of the sea, who once really did exist as a real person in a coastal part of China in the south, and then became, because she was very good at swimming, she also saved a lot of people from drowning, then became sort of Dave. So here's a prime example of folk practices become, you know, making somebody into a deity. So she was a real life person, and after she died, in one of the rescue attempts, I believe, the locals built a temple for her to commemorate her, and there was a start of her as a sea goddess. And she's very much kind of part of the pantheon now. There are sea temples across certain parts of China and in other Sinophone regions too. And she's very much one that you kind of thought of or paid respects to before you went on your travels, or, you know, went out to sea. So her history is quite interesting, and she's crossed into Western culture as well. Yes, those that have also crossed into international pop culture, I also find interesting, but I won't go into all of them because that would take ages.
Sure. Well, and I do hope you'll talk just a little bit about the intersection of pop culture, because one, you mentioned the idea of this kind of demon slayer. I think you said Zhonghua, is that who the demon slayer was?
Zhonghua.
And obviously there's an anime called Demon Slayer that I think it's set in Japan, and it's obviously different, but I think in some anime we see a lot of influence from Chinese history and mythology showing up there as well. And then obviously you talk about Chairman Mao in the book, who has this kind of political cult around him that sort of elevates him to this sort of deified status too. So I would love for you to talk just a little bit about how much, you know, political or pop culture shapes the way spirituality works in Chinese thought and life.
So religion is always linked to politics, whether in China or in any other country. Mm-hmm. In terms of China specifically, I think with the idea of nation coming into being in the beginning of the 20th century, idea of nationhood and the need to strengthen that, because China was such a place of disparate parts and where everybody spoke different languages at the time, mythology was very much employed. For example, that of the Yellow Emperor, the whole legend around him being the symbol of the Chinese civilization, etc. the Yellow Emperor, about being the founder of the Chinese civilization. All of that was linked to the idea of nation during that time, and not actually, as you might think, earlier. So that was one of the times when religion and, you know, beliefs and politics interacted closely. And also Mao, I wrote about him, not as a political figure, but I wrote about his impact on people's kind of, he was certainly a godlike figure to a couple of generations of Chinese people. And the idea popped up in my head because to include Mao, because I went to a local temple in the south of China, and usually there are shops outside selling various kinds of items for daily use, so observation of certain rituals like prayer beads or pendants of charms and things like that. And I found one of Mao with his image on it next to one of Guan Yin. And that's what encapsulated to me that he has a similar place in people's minds, or at least had. And also when I went to this small shop in Beijing, in one of the hutongs, the little alleyways of the old areas, parts of the town, and I found a New Year poster, one that you would usually have one of the household gods, like the god of longevity and happiness, but it had Mao's image on it. So I thought, certainly to his generation and the generation after, that's the place he occupied in people's consciousness. But this is very probably no longer the case in terms of, so Mao Zedong and then Deng Xiaoping is probably the last one who has this kind of iconic power around their personal figure. And I think after the party issued, after he died and the Cultural Revolution ended, and the party issued an official admittance of mistakes made in the 80s, and then thereafter, I think people have had to find new figures to attach the sense of veneration to. And I think possibly older generations still felt like that about Mao. But this was like 20, 30 years ago. And I feel like the gods of today seem very much, you know, to be the screen idols, people like that in entertainment and sports, that if you look at the fervor of fandom around these figures, they're certainly the new guises of deities. And sports, entertainment, and also esports as well, which has really grown in China. And there are possibly players that have a lot of their own little cults, and in the same way as you might, there might be a lot of enthusiasm for a movie star or a musician.
You pointed to some really good examples there of just how present this sense of connecting spiritually to important figures is, whether those figures come from sort of real life, real history, and sort of the real experience of everyday people, or whether these are legends that are being kind of elevated, or myths that exist kind of broadly within the culture. It's a very active sort of belief, and a very active sort of practice, which I think is beautiful. So you've written From Kuan Yin to Chairman Mao. You've written Synopticon, which you edited, a collection of Chinese sci-fi speculative fiction authors, which I think is wonderful. You've just written Chinese Myths. Are you working on any other projects coming up?
Yes. So I'm working on an anthology of horror fiction, which is the first contemporary collection of horror fiction from China. And that's going to be published next year, spring next year. Mm-hmm. And I am working on a project about a book about the pop culture history of wuxia and xianxia literature. And as usual, I publish on a semi-regular basis articles on my website and other platforms. And of course, I regularly appear on independent podcasts like this one, the wonderful media.
Yes, and I know that you give talks as well in person, and things like that too. So, well, we really appreciate you making the time to come and chat with us today. And hopefully people walk away from this having learned a little bit about kind of Chinese folk belief, Chinese folk practices, but then also having some curiosity. They want, maybe will hopefully want to know more about some of these figures too. And if they do, I would highly recommend From Guan Yin to Chairman Mao. I think that's an excellent book, and I hope people will check that out. So thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me.
There was once a farmer in ancient China who owned a horse. "You are so lucky," said his neighbors to him, "to have a horse to pull the cart for you." "Maybe," said the farmer. "Wait and see." Then one day he failed to latch the gate properly, and the horse got out and ran away. "Oh no, that is terrible news," his neighbors cried. "Such bad luck." "Maybe," said the farmer. "Wait and see." A few days later, the horse returned, bringing with it 6 wild horses. "Oh, this is marvelous. You are so lucky," said his neighbors. "Maybe," said the farmer. "Wait and see." The following week, the farmer's son was breaking one of the wild horses when it threw him to the ground, breaking his leg. "Oh, no," said the neighbors. "Bad luck all over again." "Maybe." "Wait and see," replied the farmer. The next day, soldiers came and took away all the young men to fight in the army. The farmer's son, with his broken leg, was left behind. "You are so lucky," said his neighbors. "Maybe. Wait and see," said the farmer. China, as it exists today, has been a long time in the making. It's important to remember, though, that while we think of it as a monolith sometimes, it is, like all nations, just people in the end. People who come from everywhere, who have their own traditions and beliefs and practices, who share those together as they continue to change and evolve over time. Will the China and Chinese diaspora of tomorrow still look like the China we know today? Probably not. But maybe. We will just have to wait and see. Our special thanks to our guest, Xueting Christine Ni, for her expertise on Chinese folklore and mythology. We'll put links to her books in our show notes, and we highly recommend that you go check out her work. If you have any thoughts on this episode or any other episodes, we welcome you to send those in to us at newworldwitchery.com. You can find all of our episodes there and find links to contact us. You can also email us directly at compassandkey@gmail.com or newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com. Both of those will reach us. If you feel like helping to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/newworldwitchery, where you can pledge $1 a month or whatever you can. Helps us out and helps us make more content, more episodes, and you get a couple of nice perks along the way, too. Thank you so much for tuning in with us this time around. We hope that you're having a wonderful 2024, a great start to your new year, and we'll look forward to sharing more episodes with you in the coming months. Until then, thanks for listening. Be well. New World Witchery is a production of New World Witchery Podcasts and is released under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. The title and closing music for this episode is Woman Blues by Paul F. Guernos, licensed from AudioSocket.